This episode, I'm joined once again by writer John Michael Greer to discuss his book, The UFO Chronicles, How Science Fiction, Shamanic Experiences, and Secret Air Force Projects Created the UFO Myth. I'd like to thank all my paid patrons and subscribers for making all of this work possible, and I'd also like to wish all my listeners a very Merry Christmas, and if you have enjoyed Hermetics this year or anything that I've created, then please think about supporting the podcast via the links below. Even a small amount goes a very long way. Once again, wish you all a very Merry Christmas and enjoy.
So, John Michael Grant, thanks once again for joining us on Hermetics for this Christmas special, which will be going out on Christmas Day. So, Merry Christmas and Merry Christmas.
Merry Christmas. Ho, 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 or something like that. So, yes, thank you very much for having me on. I'm as always, delighted to be a guest here.
I would say how many times you've been on now, but actually I've lost count. I think this is 8. I think could be 9.
It's something like that.
But we're going to be talking about your. This is actually your second UFO book.
Well, it's an extensive revisionary writing of the first one. My earlier book, The UFO Phenomenon, came out,
2009.
Getting on for a couple of decades ago, 2009, yeah. More than a decade ago then. And it was kind of what I had been able to gather on the subject approaching it through my admittedly somewhat unique analysis. And it did very well. And when the publisher finally let it go out of print, I was able to place it with another publisher quite promptly, with Eon Press, and Eon Books, rather. And the opportunity to update it and do some rewriting, because a lot more information has come out supporting the point of view that I was talking about. So I was able to rewrite it substantially. It is, I'd say, you know, it's a good 20% new material, maybe 30. And I've been able to tighten up a lot of the arguments, present much more evidence for, as I said, the somewhat unique point of view that I have on the UFO phenomenon. And so the UFO Chronicles, it's out.
Yeah, I mean, this is a very unique overview. I mean, the full title is The UFO Chronicles, How Science Fiction, Shamanic Experiences, and Secret Air Force Projects Created the UFO Myth. Now, I guess for anyone listening who's sort of wary of UFO stuff because it goes too far in one direction for them, this isn't it. Because UFOs, you know, UFOs, occultism, conspiracy theories, obscure philosophy, these all sort of fall under the same thing at times, but UFOs is one area where I sort of don't tread there very often, because I find it's the one area where there's far more charlatanism and just too far in one direction. But this book is it's written by you, so I knew it was going to be some you know, an original take.
Well, thank you.
And for, I guess what I want to, the point I'm trying to make there is that I think for anyone who's sort of, you know, skeptical of the skeptics, this is the book for you. You know, those who are wary to, those who might believe in some conspiracies but don't want to go too far into UFO stuff, this is the book for you. I think it's good. So it doesn't tread the same, what I'm trying to say is it doesn't tread the same paths as, you know, many.
No.
I think the stereotypical sort of UFO text people would go to is probably Communion. Willie Stryver,
yeah, oh yes. Or the thing is, there's been an immense literature on UFOs churned out since 1947, and it all falls into two very similar, well, not all of it, actually, fortunately there have been some new sections, but the vast majority of it falls into two very narrow categories. They're the ones that claim that any unknown object seen in the sky must be a spacecraft from some alien civilization. And there are the ones that claim that any unknown object seen in the sky never existed in the first place. Now, you'd think it would be obvious that there are other possibilities here, but to an astonishing extent, that's the debate. You know, there's a light up there. Is it a spacecraft from Zeta Reticuli, or doesn't it exist at all? And yet, you stated that boldly. It's obvious that it's absurd, but that's how things have been, and especially since about 1980, really, things have been just mired in this bizarre dichotomy between two improbable claims. Obviously, people are seeing unusual things in the sky. That's not in question. That's been documented six ways from Sunday. But what they are seeing in the sky need not be the spacecraft from Zeta Reticuli. That is what the one category of UFO books insists it has to be.
Yeah, so, I mean, it seems strange that I think the actual sort of signifier of, you know, the letters UFO is actually now different to what it actually means. I mean, because when if you take it apart, unidentified flying object. Well, that
unidentified flying object.
That
yeah.
makes more sense, right? But when you say UFO, yeah. instantly
UFO.
Hollywood yeah, everyone... and mass paperback production has changed
exactly.
that signifier to target us towards the aliens.
Yeah, exactly. UFO, unidentified flying object, something in the air that we don't know what it is. Not greetings, Earthlings. I come from planet Zarkon, or what have you. Exactly. And that weird gap, that weird resignifying of little lights in the sky to metallic saucers from which little green men or little gray men descend to, take a rectal sample or something. It's really just that watching that bit of collective psychology unfold is fascinating. And then, of course, that leads into other and more interesting directions.
Mm-hmm. So I guess before any big discussion on UFOs, I should probably ask the daring question. I'll ask it in the adult sense first, which is, what's your stand on the Fermi paradox? But then the real question there is, do you believe in aliens?
I think it would strike me as very, very unlikely if we were the only intelligent being, even within this galaxy. However, the Fermi paradox is not a paradox. That's the reason so many people have been edging around it since Enrico Fermi said what he did. The Fermi paradox is a logical disproof of the possibility of interstellar flight. If it were possible for an alien civilization, for an intelligent civilization to spread through the galaxy, they would have done so millions of years ago. They have not done so. Therefore, there's good reason to think that interstellar flight, interstellar expansion is not an option. There are very good reasons why that could very well be the case. We know that it takes fantastic amounts of energy, even to move from planet to planet within one solar system, to move any significant number of people. The thought of what it would take to build a self-sustaining colony, even on the moon, which is a whisker-thin distance from us in spatial terms, it would bankrupt any nation that tried it. The United States, when we were doing our moon launches, we were putting like 15-20% of our entire national budget into the whole moon program. And that was just to send, you know, these little rattletrap ships there for a few days and then back. To do the whole colonization thing would require more wealth than any nation has. So take that, multiply it, square it, triple it in spades, and you're not even close to what it would take to travel from star to star. There's a lot of science fiction, a lot of media. People see Star Trek. They say, oh, travel to other stars. It's simple. You just, you know, fire up the dilithium crystals in the warp drive. Dilithium crystals don't exist. Warp drives don't exist. You're talking about distances that human beings literally cannot imagine, separating us from even the closest star. So what we know from the Fermi paradox, what we know from that very clearly, is that at least within this galaxy, there are the energy concentrations, the resource concentrations, the other things that would make it possible for species to expand from one star system to another apparently don't exist. So out there in the distance, across the vast sweep of stars, there are probably, you know, many other creatures looking up at the sky and going, gosh, I wonder if something else lives there. But we'll probably never know. And neither will they.
Yeah. It reminds me of this interesting idea that, you know, I'm revealing how much of a nerd I was when I was younger here, but it came up on an old Doctor Who episode where mm-hmm. there was this idea that higher alien species categorized different alien species. And if a certain species hadn't yet got to the point where they could actually sustain themselves on other planets or couldn't actually contact other species, it was sort of like a Geneva Convention of the cosmos that they were left alone until they could. I always like the idea that, you know, the idea that, nope, we don't want to talk to Earth until they, you know, until they've matured. it's a good idea.
Yeah, there's been a suggestion for a while now that what happened is that old television broadcasts were picked up by alien civilizations on, you know, the nearby stars, and they looked at our media and said, these creatures are insane, redline the system. And there are big signs around the solar system saying, don't enter this system, the aliens on the third planet are stark staring nuts.
This reminds me of another theory, actually, I think was taken a bit more seriously, which was that if an alien species did land on any planet, they would have called, one of their sort of primary goals would be to get in contact with the most successful species on that planet. And in those terms, we wouldn't actually know whether or not that alien species had germs. So there was this sort of almost pessimistic in terms of you're a human, is aliens might come to Earth and just try contact, you know, germs, because they're the most successful thing, living thing happening.
Beetles. There's a fantastic number of beetles on this planet. H.P. Lovecraft thought that there would be, after human beings went extinct, there would be a vast and mighty beetle civilization. Maybe the aliens are waiting for that. But the thing about the Fermi paradox is not just that the aliens haven't arrived. There is no, I mean, an advanced technological species leaves traces. If you were sitting on Mars right now, you're a Martian, okay, bleep, bleep, and you're turning your telescopes toward Earth, it's very easy for you to tell that something is going on there. There's all of this anomalous energy coming out. You can pick up these light wavelengths that are coming from all of our lights and so on. You can pick up radio waves. There's evidence. A civilization that was capable of spanning the stars would leave evidence on a much grander scale. We would pick that up. We would pick up anomalous thermal signals. We would pick up anomalous radio or other electromagnetic radiation signals. There would be all this kind of stuff telling us, okay, something funny is going on there. It's not there.
Do you think that maybe the people thinking about this might be working on a level of technology which is a bit too human, that, you know, an alien's technology would be so inhuman. It's incompatible.
Possibly, but we have, again, this is kind of, all of these are arguments from, are kind of ad hoc arguments. Well, we don't see any sign of an alien technology, therefore, there must be an alien technology we can't detect. Well, the other possibility is there isn't one. The other possibility is that intelligent species rise on planets. They burn through the highly concentrated energy resources the way we're burning through our petroleum supplies right now. And then they settle down to something less, less extravagant, which forecloses the prospect of long-distance space travel. You can offer an infinite number of hypotheses to explain away any set of data. But the data we've got very strongly suggests that there may well be aliens out there. There's good reason to think there probably are, but they're not. There's no sign that they're, you know, that they're doing anything that could take them from star to star, and there's certainly no sign that they're coming here. So, and the thing is, it's difficult for people to get their minds around that because there are two factors here. On the one hand, as I mentioned, we have the pervasive presence of science fiction in our present culture. The idea, the notion of a future out there among the stars is hardwired into our collective imagination. That doesn't mean that we can have it, but that means that that's how we interpret things. We've got that set of mythology in place. And so, you know, just as people in the late Renaissance were obsessed with the idea of perpetual motion. They were convinced that they could come up with a perpetual motion machine and all these wonderful things would happen, and thousands of inventors struggled to come up with a working perpetual motion machine. It never happened. And there are good reasons why it never could and never will. But that was where their imagination was fixed. Ours is fixed on this idea of space travel. So people are going to default to that thing that they've absorbed. And of course, the second thing is we have this mythology of progress. In our contemporary life, we assume that technology always gets more powerful, more complex, more capable of doing preposterous things. You know, it's understandable because we've all seen, we've lived on the upswing of a cycle of technological development. I'm sure there were people in Roman times who were looking at their technology and saying, wow, you know, our empire is just going to keep on growing. We're going to develop more and more, you know, sophisticated this and the, like, water organs and the various other things that they had. And it's just there, you know, it's onward and upward. And of course it wasn't. It went up until it had basically picked all the low-hanging fruit and peaked and declined. And there's a thing called the fall of Rome. In the same way, our technology is not omnipotent. You know, our technology will peak. It's actually, in many ways, it's peaking right now. Most people know, they have already learned the hard way that when something says new and improved. If it's new, it's not improved. I forget who it was who was saying that the scariest word in the English language right now is upgrade.
Yeah,
exactly. Exactly. And yeah, you know that when something is upgraded, it's actually going to be worse. It's going to be clunkier. It's going to be slower. It's going to have less functionality and more problems. We've passed our technological peak. So similarly, you know, out there on Zeta Reticuli, you know, wherever they are in that cycle, they've had their technological peak too, and they're going looking at their flying saucer prototypes and saying, well, this one isn't working. I must be all this new software.
So
we have this fixation on the idea that progress must lead us to the stars because, you know, science fiction told, you know, the stars are waiting, this I know, science fiction told me so. That's our little jingle that we learn in the Church of Progress. But we're beginning to find out very slowly and painfully that's not going to happen. And since that's not going to happen, it's important to realize that, again, any unknown object seen in the sky does not have to be an alien spacecraft. It could be something else.
Mm-hmm. I guess I should play devil's advocate here and say, but what about poor old Elon, Mr. Musk. Are you,
poor
you know,
Elon
mean,
Musk.
I think I'm sort of sympathetic because I'd love to see it happen, but I'm also, you know, I also read your work and Orlov's work and resource limitations. Uh-huh. So I'm like stuck in the middle where I want to see it happen, but also realistically, I know it won't.
Yeah.
So I think he's making a good shot at it, but I think he's wrapped up in a certain form of future, which is clearly, you know, deriving from Star Trek and et cetera, et cetera. Do you think the Muskian dream is going to happen to even a certain degree?
If it does, we're going to see an immense tragedy, because one of the things that people have been trying not to realize since the mid-1970s, okay, is that up until the early 1970s, everyone was sure the governments were gearing up to do this big interplanetary exploration thing. Human beings would go to Mars, da 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 da. Then in the early to mid-70s, that whole thing got shut down. The reason why is that space probes discovered that outside of the Earth's magnetosphere, space is full of hard radiation. We've got a gargantuan unshielded nuclear reactor at the center of our solar system. We call it the sun. And it's pumping out gamma rays. It's pumping out X-rays. It's pumping out hard radiation all the time. And so if Elon climbs aboard his spacecraft with a plucky crew of you know, settlers to go to Mars, Mars doesn't have a protective magnetosphere. Okay? And so they're going to spend 9 months in space being fried by hard radiation, and then they get to Mars, and they get more of it. And then eventually they come back, or those that have not died either of radiation poisoning or cancer. But my working guess is what's going to happen is that sooner or later someone's going to raise the fantastic amount of money necessary to build a spacecraft, get into orbit, ride the home in orbit to Mars, and die there. And, you know, get sicken and die from the consequences of being bathed in hard radiation. And that's going to be the story of humanity's settlement of Mars. It may be tried again, but more, you know, there will end up being a few more dead bodies on the red planet where the soil is full of bleach. And, you know, it's a long ways away. There is no hope of rescue. So, yeah, I think that to some extent, Musk is being very practical. He has figured out that the best way to make it big time, as a sort of corporation runner, inventor, high-tech mogul, is to target those things that attract big government subsidies. When solar energy was big, he was all over solar energy. Electric cars, oh yeah, he's all over it. Because he realizes that most of the money to be made is to be made by government handouts. Equally, when it comes to outer space, NASA is eager to push off as much as possible onto private enterprise. So hey, he's good for it. He wants those hands out. He's also got his vision. He's also got his ego. And I hope that that it does not come to an actual journey to Mars, because I pity the poor, you know, the poor sods who make that trip. They are not going to do well. But, you know, it's one of those things. Civilizations when they become geriatric and fussy, tend to do stupid things like that.
Where do you think that idea comes from, that as a species, you know, the human race, the human species, that we're not truly free unless, or we're not truly perhaps even successful unless we've, you know, conquered the stars, so to speak?
It's religious, ultimately. It's the all of the rhetoric was filed off. Space is heaven, okay? And this is our attempt to make the ascension, to rise up to heaven on a pillar of flame. We can be just as free right here on Earth as we are in cooped up in little little bottles in a vacuum. It's been pointed out. People have been talking, oh, we'll be free in space. Free when the authorities control whether you get oxygen or not. In space, no one can hear you protest. So it's like living in space is like living permanently in a submarine. You know, you have no room, you have no private space, everything is tightly controlled, and if the people in charge want to, they can just shove you out the hatch, and welcome to your last second or so of life. But yeah, it's all a bunch of religious metaphors that have been taken in a stupidly secular mode. People are, you know, they want their heaven, they want their dream of freedom and of infinite expansion, and all these other religious metaphors. But because most of us, most people can no longer believe in the versions of those metaphors being marketed by religions, it gets turned into a secular religion. Progress becomes the great god whose second coming is going to take us to heaven or what have you.
Is there, you know, as you basically consider this, you know, the Muskian dream fiction, is there any science fiction narratives or texts that you consider good or consider almost realistic?
Oh, there's an enormous amount of good science fiction out there. It's just any of it that has to do with space travel unless it's a very brief and short-term space travel, doesn't qualify. One of the things that has really blinded us is that this notion that science fiction must be about rocket ships. In fact, there's a vast amount of science fiction that does not have to do with space travel, that doesn't have to do with advanced technology. I've written some myself. A lot of people have tried to sort of peer into the future and imagine what the future might be like. And in fact, I've edited a series of anthologies that were, you know, taking our current predicament literally, but not going all apocalyptic and, okay, now we all die next Thursday or what have you. The After Oil anthologies, there's a magazine called New Maps that publishes what we call de-industrial science fiction. It's talking about the future that we could get. And some of those futures are pretty positive. They don't, you know, there's that religious notion that either we rise up to heaven, aka space, or we stay bound in the flames of purgatory, namely here on Earth. All of that is religious mythology. We can have there could be amazing futures waiting for us. Right here on Earth, we just have to shake ourselves out of the fantasy of expansion through the vacuum, and grapple with the world we have, with the consequences of our own actions, and the fact that there's a lot of time ahead of us, millions of years.
Mm-hmm. There's one thing I want to jump back to before we sort of take on this heaven aspect. Mm-hmm. Is that I think I mentioned it here before, but I sort of want to touch on it again because I think it's such an interesting 10 years in terms of, you know, I think it's the most important decade is the 70s, and the 70s is so strange to me because on the one hand, this is when, you know, just as a, I guess, an instance of deindustrialized work, is when Donella Meadows' The Limits of Growth, that's when it's first published, is mm-hmm. in the 70s. But on the same coin, this is when a lot of military sci-fi is being written, this is when, you know, the space race, or, you know, this idea of the final frontier is being born. So you have these two absolutely opposite coins, and perhaps, you know, the answer's obvious, but why do you think it was that we, you know, do we take this path simply because it's just far more appealing than saying we have limits?
Well, it's, the thing is more complex than that. The 70s, it was, there were many different things. And remember that the real triumphs of the space race happened in the late 1960s. The 70s was where we ran into the barriers. And what happened was there was an enormous amount of interest in other alternatives. There was, as you saw, the limits to growth. Science fiction itself went through its most creative decade in the 1970s, no question. There was a lot of very innovative, very interesting stuff that was not stuck on the spaceship and ray gun future. And you had a whole bunch of other factors moving that could have moved us in some interesting directions. But instead, we had the backlash of the 1980s, the attempt to reimpose the myth of progress no matter what, the flight from sustainability toward, the temporary drawdown of the North Sea, the North Slope, some other oil discoveries. And so the 70s were really a window that allow us to see some of the things that might have been. And then Thatcher and Reagan showed up and slammed the door on that, and here we are.
Okay. Yep, that makes sense. Okay, so jumping back to this, Earth and ascendancy to heaven, the space is representing this sort of overcoming of our being and, becoming mm-hmm. something greater than ourselves. This is something you write about in the UFO Chronicles, and you call mm-hmm. it the great chain of being, and it's something, aliens fit onto it, but also humans, and I happen to be reading alongside this, just for something else. I was researching a book by one of George Gurdjieff's work. And I know you're not a big, I believe you're not a big fan of his work, but he talks about, these levels of consciousness. And then then I remember thinking back to Hermeticism, and this has these mm-hmm. layers of consciousness. And, is there behind this sort of will to ascend to another level?
Mm-hmm.
At a fixation with an occult myth, which has always been there.
Oh, very, very much so. Now, with regard to Gurdjieff, I'm not into the fourth way. That's not my path. It's a perfectly valid route. It's just not mine. I've read a certain amount of his work. I've read more of Svensky. But there's the great chain of being, the idea that there are levels rising above the human. A lot of what makes the idea of aliens so plausible to so many people is, again, that tendency to take religious and occult metaphors and collapse them down into the material plane, where in Hermeticism, in traditional religions, you have various levels of being, and humanity is somewhere in the middle. And there are levels as far above humanity as there are below. There are beings as much greater than us as we are greater than pond scum. And yet, in the sort of scientific version of that, that's been decapitated. That's been everything above human beings has been erased by Darwinian fiat. And we have the claim that no, we are the evolution's cutting edge. We are the smartest things around. Blah blah blah. All that sort of egotistical nonsense. And so people who don't have the background and don't have the exposure to the idea of spiritual realities, realities that transcend the material plane, they're groping for an image to make sense of the idea of beings that are greater than human. And the alien becomes that myth. The alien becomes that substitute for angels. It becomes that substitute for gods. It becomes that substitute for demons. And for, spirits of various kinds, we put them in flying saucers and make them go, take me to your leader, or what have you. Because that's our mythology, because that's the set of notions that we have stuck in our heads about what beings can be.
Mm-hmm. This, and you were mentioning that this sort of, it's a typical human trait to think, to be solipsistic in everything, culturally solipsistic, universally solipsistic. And we always have to be the center of everything, despite, Freud's the Copernican Revolution, Freud's revolution, Kant's mm-hmm. Copernican Revolution. Every single step of philosophy has basically been to say, no, once again, we are not the center of everything. But people don't listen. And this is something that's really interesting that you bring in right at the beginning of the UFO Chronicles, is this idea that, throughout history, UFOs, or unidentified flying objects, probably mm-hmm. say that, have been spotted by the likes of, Pliny and Livy, and, mm-hmm. Way, way back, just constantly throughout history. And every they have been, in once they're written down and sort of filtered through, they're a projection of that time's fears and hopes. So UFO history, UFOlogy, is this sort of history of how people are altering the unidentified mm-hmm. in the sky.
Basically, the sky is constantly throwing strange things at us. And there are reasons for that. Some of them are actually physically there. Some of them are not. That's why I mentioned shamanic experience in the subtitle that you quoted. But people are constantly looking up in the sky and seeing strange things. They interpret those strange things in terms of their cultural mythologies. So that in Pliny's time, people looked up in the sky. Okay, they see what looks like a flying shield. Okay, that must be an omen the gods have sent. Okay, what does it mean? You look it up in the omen books, blah, blah, blah. There we go. Nowadays, people look up in the sky, they see the same flying shield, and they go, oh, that must be a spacecraft from Zeta Reticuli. And it's also our cultural mythology. One of the great blind spots of modern thought is this notion that we're right. Every previous civilization, every previous culture that has ever existed was just plain stupid and wrong about the world, and they believe these bizarre superstitions. But our mythologies, our superstitions, our ingrained habits of unquestioned thought, no, those are the truth. Now, probably everybody else thought that way too. But now when we've got access to detailed records of all these other cultures and all these other ages, and we can look at that and say, well, maybe our assumptions are just as parochial, just as limited, just as narrow, just as flawed, and just as wrong as theirs were. You'd think we would see more of that. And we did get some of that in the UFO community. One of the things I want to get to as we proceed are some of the UFO authors of the 1970s who actually laid the foundations for the work I've done and made some very, very useful points that everybody's been trying to ignore ever since.
Well, I think it's a good section to begin with, but to begin with them, and it's not starting in the 70s, but you write a lot about the 14th Society, F-O-R-T-E-A-N. So I'm wondering, you know, this seems to be key to your perspective. This was at least the beginnings of, you know, this perspective on things. This was the real beginnings of a sensible skepticism.
Exactly. You've got people. Charles Fort is the great example. He's sort of the patron saint of anomaly studies, and he simply made it his business to go through mostly scientific journals and find reports of things that couldn't have happened, but were documented as having happened by qualified scientists. And he published 4 fat books on that subject, which are well worth reading even today. And his was an honest skepticism. He was saying, okay, we need to be just as skeptical of our own beliefs as we are skeptical of the, quote, superstitions, unquote, of these, quote, primitive people, unquote. He accomplished enormous things in that process. He was kind of balanced at the same time by a contemporary of his, Ignatius Donnelly, the man who more or less reinvented Atlantis, who also wrote several very popular books on anomalies. But Donnelly's idea was, I know what the truth is. And he would build these extensive arguments for the reality of Atlantis, or for the idea that Francis Bacon wrote the plays attributed to Shakespeare, and so on and so forth. And so ever since then, in the anomalistic field, you've had this strain between the two. You've had the Donnelly current of, you know, here is my pet theory and I'm going to prove it. And you have the Fort current of, I don't believe anyone's theories, even my own. Here's the data.
This sort of has I had a guest on recently, Hans Gerling, who's a parapsychologist, and it sort of reminds me of that. You know, this idea that, and it's something you tackle in the UFO Chronicles, is this binary between UFOs are absolutely 100% real. That thing we saw in the sky is 100% an alien spacecraft. And the other side of, you know, scientific materialism, or, well, whatever, but it's, no, they are absolutely 100% not real. And it's sort of, you know, it's a mirror of that vision we saw was absolutely 100% Jesus, or no, you are 100% schizophrenic. And the middle ground, you know, the 14th ground or the parapsychologist ground is, well, let's sit down, talk it through, and see what it is. You know, it might be something subjective, it might be something objective, but as soon as it's sort of subsumed into two of these camps, you've lost it altogether, really.
Exactly. And getting the UFO debate out of that, out of the rut of, either it was an alien spacecraft or you never saw anything in the first place, getting it out of that rut is the central goal of my book.
So what do you make of, you know, speaking of the more well-known ufologists. What do you make of Jacques Vallée's work?
Actually, Jacques Vallée is one of those two figures that I was going to talk about. Jacques Vallée and John Keel. In the 70s, those two broke with the extraterrestrial hypothesis. They broke with the whole alien shtick and started talking about the weird side of the UFO phenomenon. Vallée's book, Passport to Magonia, is, to my mind, probably the most important book written about UFOs, hands down, because that's the first book where somebody, where a qualified scholar, sat down, took the UFO phenomenon and said, okay, this is identical to what people were reporting in the 9th century, except then they called them fairies. And he documents it up one side and down the other. This is a continuing phenomena that it changes in response to human expectations and ideas and cultural images. And once you do that, the idea that that our science fiction mythology has to be the truth falls flat on its nose. And so, in fact, it was Vallée's, that book of his, and then the other one, which is frankly, in some ways at least as important, although it's very clear he did not push things as far as he could have, is Messengers of Deception. And that, the crucial thing, and it had a lot of very good points in it, but the most important thing in Messengers of Deception was his pointing out that if a phenomenon is trying to trick you, the methods of ordinary science simply fall into the trap. Because your ordinary scientist is assembling all the data into the picture that seems most likely. But if somebody's manipulating the data, then you're going to be led down the garden path. And so he was pointing out you have to use intelligence methods. You have to say, okay, who has a motive for lying here? Who has a motive for distorting and redirecting the data? What image is being projected here and what might be hidden behind it? He did a brilliant job of showing that. And it was on that basis that I started to, starting to apply that, that I started to catch on to one of the core things that, as I argue in my book, is what's going on behind the whole UFO phenomenon.
So who has the, for Vallée and then for yourself, who had, in terms of these, as you say, in intelligent methods of inquiry, who has the, who would want to lie about it? Why would someone want to hide it?
When you're looking about that, when you're looking at something like that, the first thing you do, if you're watching a stage magician, okay, mm-hmm. if a stage magician is about to pull his rabbit out of a hat or something like that, great. He's waving one hand around in the air. Watch the other hand. Okay. How are these UFO stories, how are these UFO images, where are they, how are they being brought to the public? Where are they coming from? Who manages them? That's how you figure out who might be involved. And in the case of the UFO phenomenon in the United States and a variety of other Western places, there is a very straightforward answer to that. The United States Air Force. An enormous percentage of all UFO materials comes out of the U.S. military or out of groups of people such as airline pilots who for many, many years were subject to military discipline by the U.S. Air Force. They were subject to certain military regulations, certain security regulations. The JANF 121, the very famous in UFO circles rule that you could not report on a UFO without the permission of the federal government or risk 10 years in prison. Okay, all of this centered on, if you trace it back, you end up with the U.S. Air Force, specifically with the U.S. Air Force Office of Special Investigations, which is their internal security and intelligence branch. Those were the back when it was still the United States Army Air Corps, as it was in 1947 when that first flurry of UFO sightings happened. They were the people who were heavily involved in marketing and massaging that one. Over and over again, when we get into all the way up to like the MJ-12 papers, where did those come from? They came from Air Force Office of Special Intelligence. It's that, nobody was even hiding it by that time. And over again, you find the greasy fingerprints of U.S. Air Force in this. Now, is this a paranoid conspiracy theory? Well, does the Air Force have something to hide? Yes, of course it does. And I'm not talking about saucers in a hangar at Wright-Patterson. In the late 1940s, The Air Force and the Navy, U.S. Air Force, U.S. Navy, were both carrying out secret high-altitude balloon tests, which produce a little silvery dot drifting across the sky. The 1947 UFO flap consists of little silvery dots tracing across the sky. Later on, you had various bright lights and tiny things moving at high altitude. This was the heyday of the U-2 and the SR-71 spy planes, which were top secret for many, many years. And of course, then we get to the 1980s, and all of a sudden, UFOs are black triangles. Gosh, what looks like a black triangle that the U.S. was testing right about then, with keeping under total secrecy? Stealth technology, okay? Now we have a new round of UFOs being sighted. I figure about 15 years from now, we'll know what the... And they're being... Actually, these seem to be coming from the Navy, because the Navy's doing most of the marketing. The U.S. military has been using the UFO mythology as protective camouflage for its secret aerial tests since 1947. And the thing is, people say, well, that can't happen. Nobody's done that. How many people still remember the incredible campaign of deception that the U.S. and Britain did to buffalo the Nazis over the location of D-Day? There were inflatable tanks. There were fake military barracks and bases right near Dover, because we were faking out the Nazis so that they'd have all their troops at the Pas-de-Calais, and we'd invade Normandy hundreds of miles away, and, of course, that's what happened. So in 1947, that was 3 years in the past. An entire generation of military planners had grown up knowing that strategic deception is a crucial element of warfare. And they wanted to deceive the Iron Curtain. They wanted to deceive the Russians, the Chinese, the various other, and to keep them from figuring out what we had. So that's where that was one of the places, I should say. That was one of the core elements of where the UFO phenomenon came from. And it's instantly clear that that's what's going on if you simply watch who is distributing the stories, who is producing this stuff. You look at the number of people from the U.S. intelligence community all through UFO investigation organizations. You look, it sticks out like anything. Once you look at it with eyes that are honed to look in terms of intelligence, not in terms of the scientific method.
But this completely backfires on the Air Force, though, right? You make it clear that this was initially a way to sort of get people's attention away, but it actually just draws people's attention more and more towards what it is they're trying to hide.
Well, but you can use that just as the in the D-Day thing. The British government, the U.S. government, put an enormous amount of energy into attracting German attention toward those camps near Dover. And there were spies hovering around all over the place. The Germans were totally convinced, and their attention was fixated by these things that were not real. So they did not notice the things that were real. In the same way, if you look at the era of black triangles, the black triangle UFOs, the black triangles people reported were slow moving. They were low to the ground. They were surrounded by bright lights. The Westchester boomerang is a great example. You know, basically, this thing's like 100 feet across. It's a triangle that drifts at about 20 miles an hour through the air. It clearly was not a stealth plane, but it was enough like a stealth plane that if somebody saw another black triangle they shouldn't see, it would be confused with the slow moving near to the ground thing. And that's the way it has generally been. Look at what's being described, and then look, especially in the older stuff where we know what the technologies were, look at what was being talked about, what people were claiming to see, what the Air Force releases, wow, that might be something from another planet. And then look at what they were actually testing, and there's always enough of a difference that you can see how the attempt at causing confusion was spread.
So then, what does one make of actual reports from abductees, people who say claim they've seen actual aliens firsthand? Was that of the fourth kind?
Yeah, the whole abductee phenomenon. There are a couple of things going on there. First of all, abusive hypnosis. I don't know what's the case in British courts these days, but in American courts, you cannot introduce testimony that was extracted by means of hypnosis, because it has proven so often that hypnosis generates false memories. It's a brilliant way to get people completely confused about what they actually saw. And during the heyday of the abductee thing, people who were saying, wow, I wonder if I was abducted by an alien. It was very fashionable. You go in and you come out with deconstructed memories. So you had that. You had the saturation effect of the media. If you look at media exposure to the idea of being abducted by an alien and track how many people were reporting it, as it hits, it always hits, it hits the media, and then you have a big spike in cases. Now, are there actual experiences going on here beyond that, beyond the artifacts of hypnosis and this, and the effect of the media? Yes. But this is, again, one of those places where Jacques Vallée's analysis works, because people have been having these experiences since before the beginning of history. We call them shamanic experiences. Okay, you're lying in bed and a strange being comes and lifts you out of yourself, and you go to a different place, and maybe things are put into your body. If you read Marcel Eliade's book on shamanism, you'll find hundreds of accounts of exactly this kind of thing, all of them in terms of the culture of the people who were having this shamanic experience. And again, since we think in science fiction terms, that's our mythology, we see the shamanic helper spirits as space aliens. Notice how many abductees end up claiming that they've picked up, they're having paranormal experiences after their abduction. They're having telepathy. They're having shamanic gifts. This is normal. And if our culture was less stupid about it, we would figure that out and you know, have some kind of category to get them, to put them to work doing shamanic activities, rescuing people's souls and things like that, the way anybody would do in Siberia.
Okay, so I guess for those who are sort of targeted, listening to this because of the UFO phenomenon, maybe expand on what a shamanic gift, or why a shamanic experience, or shamanic gift comes about.
Okay, yeah. If you read the classic texts on the subject, typically your people don't choose to become shamans. You certainly don't become a shaman by going on a weekend workshop. It happens to you. People in cultures where shamanism is recognized and in ones where they don't, you know, you'll be just lying in bed or something like that, and you will have a visionary experience. Some kind of strange being will come to you and take you away to a strange place, and then things will happen, and you'll be returned, and you'll have strange abilities. And in classic Siberian shamanism, of course, they know what to do with that. Okay, you've been on this thing, you've had this strange vision. Oh, you must be a shaman. And they assign you as an apprentice to a more experienced shaman who then takes these same abilities, trains you in how to use them, and you can then do healing and visionary work and things like that. We're not so sophisticated. We're not so clever. And so, you know, it's not all that common that somebody who's had one of these experiences gets the proper training. But here again, we're in that situation where a spiritual experience is being mislabeled as something that happens in the material plane. People encounter spirits. This happens all the time. But in our culture, we don't believe in spirits, so it must be an alien from Zeta Reticuli.
Could you ever see our society returning to the point where we might be a bit more sympathetic to that?
We're well on our way. We're well on our way. The peak of materialism in the Western world happened between about 1900 and about 1950. And at this point, there is a significant presence of people in every country in the Western world who have some background in occultism, who have some background in experiential spirituality. They know what to do in a situation like this. I've had situations myself, you know, as a fairly well-known blogger in these fields, where somebody has contacted me saying, okay, I had this really weird experience, what should I do about it? And, you know, it's easy enough to figure out what they need and, you know, get them started doing some meditation, some other basic practices, and they're fine. And they can integrate that, and they can use it in various constructive ways. So we're on our way. We've been through our period of pig-headed materialism. And that's the direction our culture went in, and it's one of those things. And now we are slowly coming out of it, and I know that a lot of rationalists are very upset about this, but tough. they had their fun.
But we could just medicate those people, right?
Yeah, and unfortunately that still happens too often. But one of the reasons that I'm very glad to be able to help people in this kind of situation is precisely that If you do some of the basic training, you have of an interpretive framework, you know how to handle these things, you don't get medicated because you don't lose control. You don't act noticeably weird. You just, well, yes, I've decided to take up meditation. I mean, you can get away with that in most circles, or you know, you're going to be taking up. Maybe you get into something a little weirder, but most people can tolerate that now.
Yeah, most people shrug it off because most people don't seem to really take interest.
Exactly, and so they're not going, oh my God, are you crazy? That's so and so's gotten into the meditation thing. And the fact that they're actually learning how to be shamans and how to help people with their gifts. The materialists don't have to worry about that, fortunately.
But I still don't think a school guidance counselor will take it very seriously, though.
No. There are many things you do not tell your student guidance counselor.
Pretty much everything.
Well, there's that, yeah. I lied through my teeth to mine, and I got out in one piece.
Yeah, I always like the answer, you know, what do you want to be when you're older? People who say things like content or happy. They go, no. That's not what we mean by that.
That's clever. I like that.
this is the area that really interests me, because this is obviously your area of expertise, is this, the occult sections. I believe you, Blavatsky, I believe you mentioned in terms of the early theosophical ideas are, along the lines of UFO experiences as occult experiences. These are what we now consider UFO experiences, abductions or telepathic experiences, have always been in the occult literature.
Of course. Of course. And they were understood in those terms. One of the things that I ended up doing in the course of the UFO Chronicles is talking about how these things sort of morphed into elements of science fiction, so that you have all this early 20th century science fiction. This feeds into into the UFO phenomenon that actually may have played a role in helping to start it. But yeah, in Blavatsky, in a lot of older occult literature, John Bellew Newbro's book OASPE, A New Bible, the Urantia book, for that matter, it's all very space age, and they use the metaphors of space. They use the metaphors of vastness, of interstellar distance, and it's simply it's one of the things that occultists have to do in every civilization, every culture, every age. You take the metaphors that people are able to think in, and you reorient your teachings so that you can present them to them, so they can understand. And this is why we had people in the 1950s and 1960s, for example, who were taking classic occult teachings and putting them in the mouths of space aliens. We have the George Adamskys of the world and so on. We have George Hunt Williamson and so on. All of these people who were occultists. They had the classic occult background. They came out of the movement that was more or less launched by Blavatsky, out of the golden age of American occultism primarily. But they picked that up and they said, okay, in order to reach another generation, a generation that's all giddy about space, we're going to reframe this. And they're very straightforward about it. I forget which of the major UFO quote contactees. Somebody said, "So this is all this alien stuff is metaphorical, right?" And the guy goes, "Yeah, of course it is." It was a way. It's a language. It's a way of communicating. And the thing to keep in mind is that from the point of view of an occultist, human beings are not too bright. We are not the summit of evolution. We are not the zenith of creation. We are not the measure of all things, blah, blah, blah. All of that self-important crap. We are one species, not ultimately all that bright. And we, as our souls are passing through this species, this form, this phase, and you have to talk to these critters in language in a language they understand. And if that involves flying saucers and aliens from Zeta Reticuli, that's what it takes. If it gets people practicing meditation and doing things like that, it's all good.
So do you think you could predict what the next language might be that these occultists, these occult phenomena are converted into? In what ways might we try to explain these in the future?
That depends so much on what's going to happen, what grabs the popular imagination. I don't think anybody realized in advance which of the various options would end up turning into the metaphors for the 20th century. And, you know, at this point, there are half a dozen things going around. There are various alternative cosmologies. Nobody knows. And since the occultist is not creating these things, the occultist is looking at saying, okay, this has grabbed the popular imagination, and that's the language I'm going to use. I'm going to be very interested to see what happens, because it's very clear to me, at least, that the whole mythology of progress is on its last legs. It is really faltering at this point. Most people are aware that, you know, the glorious Star Trek future is not going to happen. Not now.
I think,
not in the lifetime. Yeah, not in the lifetime of our species. Go on.
I was going to say, I think 2016 to 2020, with especially in the West with Brexit and now the recent Trump election, I think whichever way you sway on what happened with the Trump election, I'm in agreement with you that I think that the blows to one of the cornerstones of progress, which is democracy, have just been dealt. No one, your average person, does not believe that myth anymore.
Exactly. People have realized that democracy, you know, it's like Winston Churchill said, democracy, the worst possible system except for all of the others. It's a brutally flawed system. Its only advantage is that its outcomes are slightly better than anything else. And so you can no longer cling to the idea that the people will make the right decision. Here in the U.S. right now, I mean, both parties are basically looking at an election that both parties lost. The Republicans, well, more or less, lost the presidency, but the Democrats got clobbered in the House. They hang on to a very thin majority. That nobody can claim a mandate, and the apparent president elect is a geriatric sock puppet. I don't think anybody expects anything from him other than that he'll more or less mark time. And so there's an enormous amount of disappointment, an enormous amount of realization that you can't expect the universe to go the way you want to. You know, history does not bend, the arc of history does not bend in the direction of you getting everything you want. And that's a blow. That's a real challenge to people. But I think they're starting to process it, because a lot of people are also looking around at all of the other ways in which the myth of progress is folded out from under us. And some people are doubling down. They're getting into this or that, basically charismatic cult, insisting that if only we do this, progress will happen, blah, blah, blah. But I think most people are past that. Most people are realizing that progress is a mythology. It's something that, I mean, progress as a phenomenon happened for a while, and we ran through that, and now we're kind of running out of space. And a lot of people also are realizing that progress as a myth, progress as this idea that history necessarily moves in one direction, is poppycock. And that the future, there's not some kind of shining, wonderful, Star Trek-y future metastasizing across the galaxy waiting for us. If we want a future, we need to build one. And if we want a future, that means we may have to let go of some things that we like right now in order to build the future we want. And so on and so forth. All these normal, reasonable, intelligent things that people have been avoiding for most of a century by believing that the good fairy named progress is going to leave, you know, a shiny new future under our pillow at night or something.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So out of interest, for Curtis Yarvin, the arc of history goes left. For Spengler, it's cycles. For any Christian, it would be salvation. Where do you see the arc of history? Towards what does that end?
There is no arc of history. History is the stuff that happens. Spengler is probably closer to my view than anything else, because civilizations do have a life cycle, but it's not as exact as he indicated. He had to cram things to some extent. There is no direction to history. People do things, and things sort of unfold and develop and then wind up and wind down, and then people do something else. History is just what happens. And letting go of that idea that history has a direction, that it's headed toward salvation, or it's headed toward wherever Cthulhu is swimming next, or that it's headed in a perfect circle, or that it's heading toward a Star Trek future metastasizing across the stars. Letting go of that and realizing that, you know, all of those meta-narratives, all of those abstract mythologies are mythologies. We're projecting those onto the ink blot patterns of time, and it's not necessarily a good idea.
So teleology itself is a mythology.
Teleology is mythology, exactly. Yeah. I don't think we're headed any place in particular. And if we were, again, human beings are not that bright. We would not be likely to understand it. You know, the universe is billions, is trillions of light years across. The human brain is 6 inches long. One of these things cannot comprehend the other.
Mm-hmm. Is there anything you would like to add about the UFO Chronicles, which we haven't touched on?
The only thing I just add is that it's not a debunking book. It's not a narrow pseudo skeptic book saying, oh, these people are wrong. The UFO phenomenon fascinates me as a mythology, as the remarkable conjunction that it was of myths from science fiction and shamanic experiences and manipulation by the Air Force and manipulation by several other groups. And it's an astonishing story, and it's very colorful. It involves a lot of I think real insights into our species, and not all negative ones. And it's important not to brush it aside, not to dismiss it, and to say, well, people were just stupid, and which of course is what the rationalists all want to do. Just because those things in the air are not flying saucers, are not alien spacecraft, does not mean they're not worth study. It does not mean they're not interesting. It doesn't mean they don't have something to teach us. And so I think that's the thing that I like to stress. It is, you know, the debunking spirit of the universe is boring, get used to it. That has no place. I mean, if you really want to live that way, you're welcome to, but that's certainly not how I approach the thing. And so that's something that I think I'd like people to realize as they consider whether they want to, you know, pick up a copy of this book or get it at the library or what have you.
Okay. What can we expect in 2021 from...
Let's see. What do I have coming out in 2021? I've got a couple of things on their way out. First of all, I have some other books that, like this one, were dropped by their original publisher and have been revised. Inside a Magical Lodge will be out. That may be out already. I'm not sure. It's right around there. The new version of my book, The Sacred Book and Card Deck, The Sacred Geometry Oracle, will be out in April. And then the big one is my book on the politics of the Trump phenomenon, the book I call The King in Orange. The Magical and Political Roots of Occult Power is the subtitle. That'll be out in June. Even the people at the publisher are going, this is a really strange and interesting book. And I think it is. And so, yeah, that's going to be out. Of course, I had to delay the final drafts by about a month because we had to figure out who was going to be president next. And as that was, of course, that was not clear a month ago. And so... So that's going to be interesting. Oh, and the one other thing, over the past 6-7 years, I wrote a series of fantasy novels set in a kind of inverted H.P. Lovecraft world where the tentacled horrors are the good guys, The Weird of Hali. Well, that has actually been turned into a role-playing game. Think Dungeons and Dragons, and you're on the side of the monsters. And The Weird of Hali, role-playing the other side of the Cthulhu mythos. That'll be out, I think, in a few months. So I'm hyped about that one.
That sounds great. Yeah, it seems like a good place to finish up. Thanks
very much. Well, thank you very much for having me on.